even 3, 4, 5 years old, when I was, I'd hear something on TV or I'd hear someone singing a song, and then I'd sit down and play it and sing it.
You come early in the morning too. I really appreciate that.
Well, yeah. You gotta get up early, right?
Now, refresh my memory. Where were you born?
I was born in a little town in southern Ontario, Canada. Yeah, a little town is called St. Anne's. Mm-hmm. And I think at the time we had about 311 people in the town of St. Anne's. And I was born there on my grandparents' farm.
Okay.
And I think you'll recall that the reason for that was my father had died just a few months before I was due to be born in a industrial accident. And so my mom...
What kind of work did he do?
My father had a few businesses, but largely he was in the industrial machinery business.
Okay.
So large tractors and things like that. And they were actually demonstrating one of the vehicles, and it toppled over on him. Mm-hmm. And it was, he was from a small town in Ontario called Orillia. And it's actually the hometown of Gordon Lightfoot. You might know
Gordon. I remember Gordon Lightfoot, yes.
And it was a very hard time, and I have an older brother, so my mom at the time decided the best thing for her and my older brother, and then soon to be me, was to go and be with her parents on their farm. Mm-hmm. And they lived on a small farm in southern Ontario, and that's where I was born.
Does she have any siblings, your mother?
Yes, she has a couple of brothers, and they weren't at home at the time, so it was just grandma and grandpa, and then mom had to go to work, and grandma was working. Everybody was working, so I spent a lot of time when I was little by myself.
Did you go to school eventually? I mean,
yeah. So I loved school right from the beginning, and
but if there were 311 people, I'm imagining there weren't that many kids.
Yeah, so everybody, I think it's not that different now, to be honest. You know, people are bused in from all over the place to one central school.
Okay, did you have to get on the bus to go to school?
So, we live fairly close to the school, but when I was really little, I was on the bus too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was a great school, and I still have very fond memories and a lot of friends even from my first days at school.
You still have them?
Still have them. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, some of us are friends on Facebook, and others of us just keep in contact.
Did most of your friends stay there in that area, or did you get most people just kind of scatter out? It's a small town now.
Yeah, it's a small town, so some scattered out, but there's still a remarkable number of people that kind of stayed close by. Mm-hmm. So when I go home to visit, everyone, you know, all my family has passed away now pretty much, but when I go home to the old house where I grew up, there's still a lot of people in the community that I remember, and we
didn't remember you.
We get together. Yeah.
Okay.
It's amazing.
So, what's the major industry right now in that community, or is there anything?
Well, it's still mainly farming. You know, people. It's become a little bit of a bed town. It's from that town to a large city, say Toronto, is about an hour and a half by car.
That's not so bad. Yeah.
So some people actually commute.
Okay.
And now with work at home, you know, some people go a couple of days a week and then spend the rest of the time on the farm.
But what kind of farms are these?
So when I grew up, we had a mixed farm. We had everything from corn and wheat to cattle and dairy and pigs and chickens and horses.
Well, how many acres are we talking?
A couple hundred acres. Yeah, so for Canada, it's a fairly small farm.
So you could actually look, but you could see to the end. You could see to the horizon of your property.
Well, it's a little bit hilly, so you can't really see the end. No.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you'll know, and as you move west in Canada, you don't even talk about acres and hectares anymore. You talk about sections of land.
That's how big it is.
And a section of land is, you know, I forget how many. Like 1,000 acres.
1,000 acres.
Right? Yeah. So then you talk about, and that's when you start to talk about. Yeah, some people have like 15, 20 sections of land, which would
To do what with? For farming?
For farming. So that would be a large wheat farm, for example, right?
Okay.
And I think in the U.S. you have something
similar,
quite similar, right, in the wheat belt, or large potato farms in the U.S. as well. But yeah, it's when you talk about that, I think I did some measurements once, and I think some of the farms are actually bigger than Tokyo.
I can imagine that.
Yeah.
I can imagine that.
Almost the size of the Kanto Plain, some of the farms, which is really hard for a lot of people to
fathom,
to comprehend.
So tell me, growing up, what kind of kid were you? Were you academic or were you more sports-minded, do you think?
Well, I've always been an extraordinarily curious person, so intellectually curious. I've always wanted to explore everything. You know, I was the kid that you know, kind of watched the chicken laying the egg and tried to figure out what was going on. And,
don't tell me you tore apart a couple of chickens trying to figure out. I mean, you're a little sadistic little kid going up there tearing the chickens apart trying to figure out where they came from.
But I did dissect some frogs when I was a kid.
I bet you did.
Yeah. So I was always really curious. And that's, you know, when I eventually got to Asia and started to, as you know, Japan and China and much of Asia is really intellectual candy to someone who's curious.
This would be. But what about sport? Were you involved in any type of
sports? So I was involved in basketball from a young age. I always loved basketball.
Did you have the height too? Were you pretty tall?
Yeah, I was pretty tall for my age. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I was. I think I had a little bit of value, but I wouldn't say that was my main thing. You know, my main thing has always been music. I've always loved music, and from a very young age, I was. I've always felt that music was my first language, and whenever I communicate, you know, it's first of all I communicate with music, and then everything else.
Which instrument did you start with?
Well, we had an old piano at home, and I remember my earliest memories, even 3, 4, 5 years old, when I'd hear something on TV or I'd hear someone singing a song, and then I'd sit down and play it and sing it.
Without having any lessons at all?
Yeah, that's right. That's how it started.
Okay.
And then I was very fortunate. Some people from the church heard me play, and they actually got me a teacher with the Royal Conservatory of Music in Toronto. And so from a young age, I actually graduated and did a lot of piano concerts and music. And that's what brought me to Asia in the first place.
Okay, take us there. What happened? How old were you at this time? 16, I think you said? Or what?
Well, yeah, I even from the age of 10, 12.
You came to Japan when you were 10 and 12?
Not then, but okay. I was doing concerts, and I was playing in church a lot and helping with the choir at school and things like that. And then I got a scholarship to go to a boarding school, which, again, I'm extraordinarily grateful for.
What age?
A school called Niagara Christian College. And I started going there when I was about 12 years old.
Okay.
And at that school, many of the students were from Asia. So that was my first introduction, really, to Asian cultures and Asian people.
I had a roommate. Your town was pretty
well, that's right.
Homogenous.
That's right, of course.
I would think so, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I remember my roommate was from Hong Kong, and so we fooled around and learned each other's language a little bit. And so one day we would speak Cantonese, and the next day we would speak English. And, you know, and so I gradually came to become even more curious about, you know, that part of the world, this part of the world, and wanted to know more. And I traveled to Hong Kong and China when I was quite young. And then I came to China in 89. Right. At the tail end of Tiananmen Square incident, and I was teaching music for the most part, so improvisation.
You're already teaching now.
That's right.
So how old were you then?
Well, I was 18 then.
18, okay. So the first time you came here, you were 18 years old.
That's right.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And then I came to Japan on the same trip.
And the purpose was to actually teach.
That's right. It was doing mainly music and. And I, you know, I came from a very, you know, quite moderate to poor family. Okay. And so, you know, I kind of did whatever I could do. And I taught English and I taught piano.
But no one brought you over here. You came on your own?
The first time I came on my own. The second time I came with an organization called English Language Institute China,
okay.
which was out of California. And then when I came the next time, I came on the Momshu program.
How'd you work that out? How'd that happen?
Well, I was teaching actually at a school in Quebec, in northern Canada. So
do you speak French?
I speak French as well.
Okay.
Yeah, I grew up speaking English and French.
What, were your parents, were your mother, your father, your grandparents?
Just always been very curious. So I studied a lot on my own.
And so your mother and your grandparents don't speak French at all?
No, they don't.
Okay. So they're that part of Canada. So you went to the whole different Canada, which is Quebec.
Well, that's right. And so I studied in university, I studied linguistics and I studied Hebrew and Greek and Latin and then French and Italian. And so it was kind of natural for me to go. I did one of my degrees in French at University Laval in Quebec City. And so I decided to go to even further northern Quebec and to get a teaching job. And it was during that year of teaching that I kept thinking back to my trips to Asia and my friends and really wanted to get back. And so that's when I...
How much time did you have while you were here the first time?
About 6 months.
Oh, 6 months, okay. And then you had to get back.
That's right.
Okay.
And so through applying to the government and looking for different programs, you know, I found the JET program. And I thought, well, this looks like a great opportunity, and so I applied, and they brought me to Japan, and I was with the Saitama Board of Education, and they sent me out to a little town called Chichibu,
which is my father-in-law is from.
Right?
That's right.
And then and then Chichibu sent me even further out to a little town called Ogano.
Okay.
Which you know, I still love the place.
Didn't you say that you still your mother? You call your Japanese mothers in Chichibu.
Well, that's Shiodano. Right. Well, that's right. So I was supposed to do a 3 week homestay with a family in Chichibu, and it turned into 3 years. And and even today, I call them mom and dad. You know, my mom and dad have passed away, and so. They're
but
really,
your father passed when you were young.
Well, that's right. Yeah. So they're really my mom and dad.
That's beautiful.
And my kids call them grandma and grandpa.
But you were telling me also, I remember from the first time we spoke, that when you first came, they dropped you off. She comes up to you. You come up to her. She speaks not a lick of English. And you spoke no Japanese. And you guys sign language your way into having dinner or something or coming into the house.
No, that's right. That's right. Well, it was really the son of the house. Who came up to me?
The youngest son,
right?
Started teaching
and started teaching me, and then he said, you know, you should come and meet my mom. I was kind of taken aback, but I said, you know, what the heck, you know? So I went to their home, and we said, yeah, well, let's try a short term homestay because everybody got along, but like I said, it turned into 3 years, and it's one of the closest relationships I have to anybody on the planet.
Tell me, just for the people out there that have never done anything like that, what did that entail? How did you really get in with the family so they wanted you to stay longer? What do you think were some of the things you did or chores you had? Or was it because of the income you were bringing in? What did you do you think, that got them to want to stay other than just being someone they liked?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, Lance. And I'm not sure if I have a great answer, you know. A quote from Jack Ma comes to mind where he says, you know, a stupid man speaks with words, and a smart man speaks with his brain, but a wise man speaks with his heart.
Okay.
And that comes to mind because, you know, I just think more than anything in this world that heart-to-heart communication is really where things really begin to grow.
No. Explain that, because heart-to-heart could mean different things to different people.
You know, I think the first thing is you really have to observe what's going on and figure it out.
Okay.
And then try to understand, then knowing yourself and how you can add value and how you can be part of the family unit, you know, without causing problems and without people feeling uncomfortable.
Okay.
Right? And, you know, some families would just feel extraordinarily uncomfortable just by having a stranger there to start with, right?
That's what I'm asking. So in that case, Glenn, how did you fit in? What did you do that made that family feel? What did you maneuver yourself into finding out was best for you and that family?
Oh, that's a great question. I think more than anything, what I said at the beginning, I think, is most important, just to preface it with that acting from the heart and believing in your heart that you know, honestly and sincerely wanting to be there, honestly and sincerely wanting to be part of the family, honestly and sincerely from your heart wanting to love these people. That's the first thing. The second thing is to imitate, I think, the behaviors of other people that are already adding value in the family.
So what'd you do? Who do you imitate?
So you look at the mother. The mother in a Japanese household, in a traditional Japanese household, does a lot of the daily tasks, right? So, you know, you watch her make, you know, the miso soup in the morning. And then you figure out, maybe you get up 15 minutes earlier and then you make the miso.
Is that what you did?
That's what I did.
That's what I'm asking. That's so you're making it like, it's, don't tell them. I want to know what you did.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so you made the miso soup. Okay, and then what else?
And then
did you do it just, you did it for everyone?
Yeah, for everybody. That's what the mother does.
Okay, all right.
And so, you know,
How did she respond to that?
Well, at first she was a little uncomfortable and she kind of giggled and thought it was silly. Okay. And then everybody complained about the miso soup that it didn't taste right, right? But it was all kind of fun. Okay. And then at the end of the day, they understood that I was really making an effort to be part of the family.
Did you ever make it? Did you continue to do that?
Yeah. And other things, you know, I think my roles kind of grew, you know, even from simple things like doing the dishes.
Okay.
Right.
So you started
helping doing the dishes.
Right.
And that's a great opportunity to communicate as well. Right. To stand beside the mother of the household and just help wash the dishes.
And you said you stayed for 3 years. Yeah, so that means, right. So during that time, so you actually did become integrated in the family so that you were taking on some of the chores that you saw other people were doing.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
And eventually, did they start to like your miso soup?
They did.
Yeah. How long did that take? Because then she probably started coming along and saying, okay, a little bit more of this or a little bit less of that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It probably took 3 or 4 months.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did you, is that it? Was it just the miso, or did you do other main meals?
No, I love cooking anyway. So we always cook together.
Give me a full meal.
Oh, we cooked anything from karage to more Western things. I remember making them some real Italian, like tomato sauce from scratch, or pesto. Making
which
pesto
they did
from
not
scratch.
Do. Which they did
well, they
not
had
do.
No idea of, right? Or making crepes for breakfast or something, right? That's really a very strange
thing. Now you're getting into what I'm talking about. Because the reason why I'm saying that, Glenn, is because people really come over here and they don't know how to interact. And you said the right thing to preface it by saying it has to come from the heart and show that you're not doing this just to be mimicking or anything. You're doing it because you truly love them and you care about the fact that they care about you. And let me help you. Yeah. But I'm sure, what did they resist you on? What are some of the things that you finally got through, but they resist you on? Oh, and who was it? The mother, the father, the little brother of yours you had there?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure if there really was much resistance other than just the, you know, Japanese families in general are pretty private organizations.
They're conflict diverse. They don't want to create any conflict.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
And typically outsiders aren't allowed in the house anyway. And so we're already way past the borderline of what we're supposed to be doing here, right?
They don't invite their neighbors inside.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And here's this big ugly foreigner hitting his head on all the ceiling. You know, it's a pretty strange thing to start with, which I felt honored to be able to experience, and I still do. And you know, now I walk in the house as if it's my own. You know, it's you know, that relationship will be there forever, and it's amazing.
Did you ever help the family any kind of ways monetarily? Did you ever contribute that way?
Well, yeah. So that obviously came up along the way, and we did come to arrangements, and then their children, two of their children, actually went and stayed with my family, in Canada.
On the farm?
Well, yeah, but my mom had moved off the farm and had her own place, and so they went and stayed with my mom when she was still alive, and the boy went to school in Canada, and then he went to university in the United States, and then eventually came back to Japan.
Fluent in English and just having a good time. What about his sister?
His older sister also stayed with my mom, and she went to university in Canada,
and she's fluent as well.
Yes, and so you know it's a. It became an incredible relationship, really.
Okay. Yeah. So they really integrated you into the family. I mean, yeah,
that's
wow.
Right. That's right.
So they had two Japanese kids and one Canadian. That was beautiful.
Yeah. And she still introduces me as her son when we go out in public,
she?
Right? And then everybody kind of looks and says, wow. Because she's a very tiny Japanese lady, right? I think she probably only weighs about 40 kilos or 45, right?
Yeah.
And I'm about 43, so... No, so it's amazing. But that's you know, it's amazing how the eyes kind of trick us or change the way we view things because, you know, she really does view me as her son and she doesn't think that's strange at all anymore.
Where would she? She raised you. She's seen everything about
yeah,
you.
That's
she's,
right.
She smelled you. She knows
that's
you.
Right. That's right.
And vice versa.
That's right.
Because, so tell me this. So now we've gone over what it's like for you to integrate into a Japanese family. Outside of business, when you came here and started doing business, what was that like for you?
So I was in a think tank. Just before I went back to graduate school, I was in a think tank here with the Prime Minister, with Hashimoto Prime Minister, and then with Obuchi Prime Minister.
How did you end up getting this think tank with them?
So I was working for an organization called CLARE, which is the Council of Local Authorities for International Relations, which is a semi-governmental organization managed by the Ministry of Education, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and the Ministry of Home Affairs. And that organization, CLARE, manages the JET program. They also manage all the sister city relationships in Japan. You know, there's like 12,000 sister city relationships throughout Japan. As well as other sports exchanges and things like that is handled by the organization that had hired me. And while I was there, you know, the bubble had burst and the economy wasn't doing so well and several of the prime ministers had tried to set up plans to stimulate the economy and to get the economy out of the ruts. As well, they believed that it had a lot to do with the education system, so they wanted to change the education system. So they put together this think tank, Kondankai, at the Prime Minister's official residence. And it was a bunch of politicians, and they wanted a couple of foreigners in this group. And so I was invited to be part of this group. And I was honored to be there. You know, we did reports on NHK and talked about, you know, what we were thinking. And but as a musician, you know, I knew nothing about the economy, right? So I learned a lot, I studied a lot, and I realized this is something I really wanted to know more about. And that's when I decided to go to graduate school. So I went to the U.S. and did my MBA at the Wharton School, and then I did an MA at the Lauder Institute, and from there went to work on Wall Street. So I started working on Wall Street just a few months before 9/11 happened. Mm-hmm. And the building I was in was destroyed, so I was running down the stairs and then my apartment was also destroyed in 9/11, and so I ended up in a hotel in New York City. And from there, I was hired by Mizuho Bank in New York City. And then they eventually sent me back to Japan.
You think your Japanese speaking ability helped you any to get into Mizuho?
Yeah, so Japanese speaking ability is an interesting one. You know, by that point, I was fluent in Japanese. In fact, I published, I think I mentioned this book last time, but a friend and I published this book about learning Japanese.
Stockproof Japanese.
and so yeah, I think speaking Japanese was an important part of my career and being able to come back to Japan. But strangely enough, you know, in a lot of jobs in Japan, after you get kind of in the company, foreigners that don't speak Japanese have quite a big advantage. For those of us who speak Japanese, there's extraordinarily high expectations to kind of be Japanese, right?
Which you can never be.
So that's where the that's where the controversy, the dichotomy really is, right? Because on one hand, they expect you to be fully Japanese. On the other hand, they believe that you aren't Japanese and you never will be.
Also, what happens when you're trying to go up the ranks, they say, you can't because you're not
Japanese. Exactly. So it's a double-edged sword.
They get you to work.
Yeah, that's right.
Butt off to try to be Japanese.
That's right.
But when you want to get the raise and go up, guess
no,
what?
No, you're not Japanese. That's right. And then the reverse thing happens, too. So when you go back to working in on Wall Street in New York, then you're viewed as the Japan guy. Right? And then you can't move up there either.
Right.
Because you're the Japan guy.
Right, you're the Japan guy.
If you want to move up, you go back to Japan.
Japan's really slowing your move down right.
But you know, thankfully I had a long career in finance and I loved it. I was at Goldman Sachs for a long time and that was a fantastic experience.
What are we talking about? It had to be at least a decade.
Yeah, so altogether I was in finance for about 20 years.
Okay, 2 decades.
Yeah. Then. And I loved it. You know, it was
And what made you decide to get out? So this is also considered successful because for you to come here, starting off only being able to stay for 6 months at the beginning, right. Then to come back and to get in with a family, and it took time. And nobody's given you any kind of guidebook on how to do any of this. Like you said, you were just letting your heart lead you through it. Mm-hmm. And did music help you in any way, do you think?
Well, as I mentioned, music is really my first language.
Did they have a piano at their home?
They did. Yeah. You know,
before you came?
Yes, that's right. And then I brought some more pianos with me.
but who played the piano?
So the kids had taken piano lessons.
The mother didn't play?
And the mother played a little bit. And actually, she's still taking lessons now.
Okay.
Music has always been my first language. Mm-hmm. And it's always a way to communicate with people.
So that helped you quite a bit?
Oh, it helped me a great deal.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
because you don't need words for that. Those are their own words. Really a feeling.
That's right.
So then you went through the financial institutions for 20 years, and then you decided to stop. Why?
Yeah, so I got the fantastic news. At the time, my last job was at Mitsubishi Morgan Stanley, global head of their equities, the international part of their equities business. And it was a fantastic job, and we had extraordinary success gaining market share from global financial institutions. And I got the great news in 2015 that I was going to be a dad, and I was really excited about that. And then in October of 2015, the hospital called me. My son was being born overseas. My partner was overseas at the time. And my son had been born prematurely, and it was life or death. And they were sending me these pictures with tubes and machines, and it was really scary. And I was, as a first time parent especially, I was shocked, and I didn't know what to do. But the hospital said, you know, you need to come right away. You know, we're not sure if he's going to make it or not, and you absolutely have to be here. And that was late at night, and so I woke up really early. You know, 4 o'clock in the morning the next day, and was in the office, I think, by five or so, waiting for people to come in, because I wanted to, you know, having lived in Japan for such a long time, I really wanted to do the Japanese thing, right, and to be respectful and to explain what had happened and to get their understanding. You know, my gut was saying, just get to the airport and get out of here. But I really felt I needed to go in and explain things to everybody. And unfortunately, you know, and even today, I'm shocked when I think about this. You know, basically, my Japanese bosses just turned around and said, you know, don't worry about it. Sit down and get back to work. You know, it'll be okay. And I just, you know, my first reaction to anybody as a manager that would come to me with any sort of family emergency, the first thing I say is go. You know, you need to be with your family.
That's a cultural thing too, as you know.
It's a cultural thing.
It's a cultural thing. But the thing is, you really do have a case that's still ongoing.
Yeah, that's right.
When did it start?
So my son's now 8 years old.
So it started 8 years ago?
Started about 8 years ago, yeah, a little more than 8 years ago.
I mean, it hasn't come to a conclusion yet.
Well, that's right. So the recent chapter is that we're in the Tokyo Labor Commission is looking very carefully at the case, and yeah, but it's just amazing that I've written a book basically about what happened and what
you had 8 years to do it.
Well, that's right, and what I focus in the book on sustainability actually, because it's I find it so ironic that today so many companies talk about SDGs and ESG and all these acronyms, and everybody wears the SDGs badge and talks about sustainability and managing a company sustainably. But I think that many companies and many managers don't actually understand what that means. What do I do? I think is a lot of questions I got when I interviewed managers for the right. book. You know, so somebody calls them up and says, SDGs, you know, you got to manage more sustainably. We need something for HR, you know, for advertising purposes. You know, but the average manager doesn't know what to do. What's it mean? How do I change what I do to meet these new guidelines?
How do we do that?
How do we do it?
Tell me.
And so that's what I wrote the book about. Okay. And I include my story in the book that, you know, firing pregnant women or firing employees for trying to take time off for family, that's actually non-sustainable behavior. That's going to lead to troubles for your company, whether you're a greedy capitalist or whether, you know, you're concerned about climate change or whatever your particular concerns are. That behavior is non-sustainable. That's going to lead to lower profits. It's going to lead to more problems in the company. It's going to lead to it being more difficult to hire good people. It's going to lead to motivation issues with employees, etc. And so it might have worked 30 years ago or 50 years ago, but in 2024, that's non-sustainable behavior. It's the same with destroying the environment, right? So if you're a company making some product and you know that in this area you're actually damaging the environment, well, that might have worked 30 or 40 years ago if it impacted the stock price and shareholders wanted to buy that and short-term gain. But now that's not how investors are investing. That's not how people are thinking. People want, and I believe that the original definition of capitalism itself is generating outsized profits while adding extraordinary value to society. And somehow that last bit has fallen by the wayside to a certain extent, I think. And it makes sense though, right? If you're not adding value, then you shouldn't be generating profits anyway, right? So the two really go hand in hand. And shareholders are asking for that. Employees are asking for that. And I think that really, if people focus on that definition of capitalism, I think you'll come back to a much more sustainable way of managing mm-hmm. businesses. And I go into detail in the book about that.
That's beautiful. Do you have the book with you?
Well, I've got just a copy of what the front cover is going to look like.
Good. And it's not out yet.
It's not out yet. It's okay. Going to be out soon.
Okay.
And
Too big to care.
And on
too
my
big to care. This is beautiful.
On my company homepage, if you look at smartvisionlogistics.com, /book, I believe is the URL.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be able to sign up and get a free copy of the book. Many people will be able to get a free copy of the book. So
how many people?
Wow.
You're gonna do the first one. How many?
Because probably
some people to know. Then you're gonna get my free copy real quick. The first two people that sign up. Get
No. Right, okay. No. It'll be a couple hundred anyway.
That's good.
That we're happy to spread the news.
When is it due out?
It's due out early next year, so we're okay. Looking at first quarter.
Because we're ready. This is next year's right around the corner. I mean, well, that's a couple of days before next year.
Yeah, that's right. So we're really excited about the book, and we're hopeful that my story and my experience at Morgan Stanley will really be inspirational.
Was this a collaboration? Did you have somebody else that helped you with the book, or was it just you?
So it's great that you asked that. Mm-hmm. So my business partner is a guy called Tatsuhiko Nakazawa, and we started our current business. It's called Smart Vision Logistics. We started it in the middle of this case that is ongoing with Mitsubishi and Morgan Stanley. And what our thinking was, we actually met in Ogano. You remember we talked about Ogano. So he was
after Chichibu.
I think he was 13 years old at the time, and he was one of the students that I met at the school.
Yes, you mentioned that the last time we talked.
Right? And his family had a logistics business. So he invited me home to meet his family, and then we all went out to karaoke and had a great time. And over the years, we became close friends, and his family and I became also very close. And I gave them some financial advice about the business over the years. And he was at the point where, you know, he wanted to do something on his own. He'd been in the family business forever.
Which is the logistics business.
Well, that's right. He wanted to strike out on his own. And we talked about starting something together, but I was always so busy in my financial career. But at this point, with the lawsuit going on and him wanting to start something new, we said, well, maybe this is it. And we took it as kind of God's guidance that we should try and start something.
Well, how many trucks do you have now?
So we're up to about 60 trucks now.
They're beautiful, too.
Well,
thank you. The design on them.
Thank you.
And the commercial is beautiful, too.
Thank you.
You should be.
I'm glad you,
goodness.
You took a look. Please take a look at
SmartVisionLogistics.com. How long have you had SmartVision? How long have you had it?
So it's almost 5 years now since we started it. We started it about a year before COVID started. And then with COVID, the whole logistics industry just took off. And so we were very blessed that we really had some tailwinds. And we do mainly chilled logistics. So we do a lot of fruits and vegetables, a lot of fresh foods.
Now, you're not competing with this family, are you?
Well, there's a little bit of overlap, but there's, you know, it's, as you know, the logistics industry in Japan is so fragmented. There's 5,000 odd logistics companies.
You're talking to me, right?
Japan, right?
I know.
And many are in the red, and many are just one or two trucks, and it's really ripe for consolidation. And we also believe that through our company growing, that we intend on doing M&A.
Now, how long have you done this?
Well.
How long has it been?
So it's been almost 5 years now.
5 years you've been doing it.
Yeah.
And it's called?
Smart Vision Logistics.
Smart Vision Logistics. Okay, I'll make sure that's running underneath you while you say
thank
that.
You. Thank you. Thank you.
Smart Vision
Please take
Logistics.
A look. It's We have a blog that we update regularly, and we've written some pretty stimulative blog posts, I think. Some of them are really fun. For example, obviously, you know, we really believe in women in leadership. And so we're constantly looking in our company to hire women managers and women drivers. And versus the competition, we have a higher percentage of women in our company than others. And in Japan, I think it's a huge underutilized resource. And we're really excited about our women employees. Mm. Other things we do, you know, we have very strict non-harassment policies and obviously maternity and paternity leave policies. We have a young lady that joined us recently, and I think there's a blog about this, or it might be coming. She told us this story, and Lance, it brought tears to my eyes. She got pregnant with her second son, and she had to take maternity leave. And when she went back to work, lo and behold, similar to what happened to me, they basically put her in the corner and wouldn't give her job back and treated her like crap. And it's you know, it's the age-old story, you know? We want women employees, but not if they're pregnant or have kids. And she tells this story about how, since she's come to Smart Vision Logistics, that she feels liberated, and she feels that she's found a place where she can really add value and still take care of her family. And that's what it's about.
That's so true.
That's what it's about.
That's true.
Family has to come first. If you don't have family, what do you got? Right?
That's right.
Yeah.
So
that's our belief.
This has been really good. I think we've covered a lot of good areas, too. Listen, before I finish the podcast, I always like to ask this question. I asked you last time. I'm going to ask you again this time. If you could go back in time, over all the things you've done up till now, and meet the younger Glenn, what advice would you give him, and how old would that Glenn be?
Yeah, I love that question, Lance. I think it's really important to understand that being a victim in this world really doesn't mean anything, and it's actually disempowering. So whether you're a victim or not doesn't really matter. What matters is you're thinking about it and believing that whatever happens to you and whatever your condition or whatever your experience or or wherever you are in life, that you're a victor. And I think if I could go back, I would probably go back somewhere around you know, a very young age, and just say, you know, this life is happening for you. It's not happening to you.
Couldn't think of better words, buddy.
Love those. Thank you.
Same here, Glenn.
Thank you.
I want to thank all of you for watching or listening to this podcast. Make sure you press like and subscribe. And always remember, it's all on loan, so continue to reach for the stars.
Because you're too blessed to be stressed.